spotlight of the Latino Media Collective. The Latino Media Collective delivers consequential coverage from the biggest countries in South America to the smallest enclaves of Central America and the Caribbean, and is available on SoundCloud, iTunes Podcast, and Google Play Music. The Latino Media Collective is recorded in WPFW Studios and airs Fridays at 1 p.m. on WPFW Washington.
Committee Watch and Comment for Tuesday, March 26th. How are you? It's great to be with you. And we are joined by our esteemed guest from the Institute for Policy Studies, Curry Peterson Smith. Welcome to Committee Watch and Comment. It's great to have you.
Thank you, David. Grateful to be here.
It's great to have you, and we'd love to hear from comments from our listeners, 202-588-0893, very important topic we're going to discuss today, the situation in Gaza. I mean, it's just this horror unfolding. It's really kind of... needless to say, horrific and ongoing. What's your current understanding, sir, about the situation in Gaza? I mean, it's really unspeakable.
It is unspeakable. You know, as so many are pointing out, this is the first live stream genocide. You know, it's the most, as you know, scholar Nora Erekat points out, it's the most well-documented genocide in world history. And the fact, however, that everybody knows what's happening, that in and of itself does not stop it. And each week it sinks into a new depth. And so the level of starvation at the moment is truly horrifying. And as humanitarian experts warned months ago, including the World Food Program and the World Health Organization, starvation and disease have the potential to kill more people than even the bombs and the shells. And so we're seeing that kind of thing unfolding. And Israel has, there's no sense whatsoever that Israel is planning on stopping anytime soon. And they feel confident to continue because whatever the U.S. says, they continue to receive American weapons, which are really fueling this whole thing. And so that my assessment is that it really, really matters, the protest wave that we've had in this country, to work to disrupt that flow of weapons and to stop U.S. support for Israel. That's really critical, because it's not going to come from Israel itself. It's not going to come from the White House. It has to come from the people.
Yeah, I mean, I heard there's some survey that says that 2/3 of the Israeli public is for stopping any kind of humanitarian aid to Gaza. I mean, it's not going to come from Israel. I mean, the attack by Hamas on Israel on October 7th, this is clearly horrific. But you know, the question becomes, is it okay to accede to the ongoing assault on Gaza? I mean, is not either or. I mean, right. Objections, you know, there's no question that the assault by Hamas on the Israeli populace in October 7th was horrific. I mean, clearly, excuse me, but does that justify what's going on, you know, almost half a year later in Gaza? Justify it? I mean, that's the question, and the bigger question for us as United States citizens, do we want to continue to support this?
Right. I mean, yeah, nothing could possibly justify what we're seeing, the systematic starvation of a population, the systematic bombing, the destruction of every single university in Gaza, the targeting of every hospital, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Nothing could possibly justify that. And when we talk about October 7th, you know, which is a day that frankly could use much more conversation and discussion about what actually happened. And it's worth noting that until there is a ceasefire, by the way, there can't be any kind of investigation to what's happening anywhere, actually. There is no independent investigation of what happened on October 7th in Israel. There's limited possibility of investigation of what's happening in Gaza right now. So this is another reason why the ceasefire is so important if we're concerned about the humanity of everybody involved in what has transpired. It must be said that, you know, prior to last October, this place, Gaza, was blockaded for 16 years and bombed throughout that time, but in major bombardments four different times. You know, the kind of what we're seeing now in terms of the severe restriction of any food or fuel or anything allowed into the strip, we have seen at a different level a version of that for 16 years. And what's so disturbing is that it didn't really register at all as a reality in this country. For 16 years, there was no real conversation about that blockade.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? And so it makes one wonder, the October 7th attacks, is that what it took to call attention to this horrific ongoing starvation? And if the answer is yes, then I think that forces some questions actually that we should be asking in this country about our media and our government, you know, which accepted that blockade as so-called peace, you know, the claim being that the peace was disturbed on October 7th. Well, there was no peace in Gaza before that day. So my hope is that we can have, we need to, I mean, the situation demands not only a serious intervention to stop this genocide in Gaza right now and a serious interrogation of what's happening today, but also a reflection on what happened on October 7th and on October 6th and the 5th and all, you know, that is just, let us now finally have a real conversation about Israel and Palestine in this country.
Right. I mean, why don't we accept as a given that the events of October 7th were, you know, I don't know how to say it, out of line, unacceptable.
Yeah.
And yet understandable, given the context of what, as you say, had happened in the last 16 years. I mean, I think that, from what I understand, the events of October 7th in terms of the Hamas incursion into Israel proper were understandable, predictable in the sense of of in the larger picture, breaking up any possibility of rapprochement between Israel and countries like Saudi Arabia. I mean, that's my understanding of of what happened, that it would break up any a possibility of a rapprochement between Saudi Arabia, Arab Emirates, etc. And it certainly seems to have done that. But in the broader picture, I'd like to take a step back and understand the geopolitics, if you will, and what happened about over 40 years ago, when Israel was going after the Palestinians in Lebanon, and Ronald Reagan said to the then Prime Minister of Israel, Menachem Begin, "Hey, cut it out. This is out of line, and stop it." You know, and he said that as you know, the American government, who was and is the primary military supporter of Israel, saying, "Hey, this is going too far. You're killing innocents here." And Begin responded and stopped the incursion into Lebanon. That's not happening from our president, President Biden. You know, we get tough rhetoric from Senator Charles Schumer, the highest elected Jewish official in the American government. But in terms of actually stopping U.S. military aid to Israel, that's not happening. Your thoughts about that, sir?
Well, I'm so glad that you're bringing up that history of the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, because it is so relevant here for so many reasons. And just to say, that was another situation where Israel was really trying to transform the reality, to change the map. And that took, that involved tremendous violence, you know, an unreal level of violence, that played a critical role in the horrific civil war in Lebanon. And by the way, was the context, in which Hezbollah, emerged. So the notion that an Israeli invasion could stop the, you know, a force that is fighting Israel, the very opposite happened, in Lebanon. Hezbollah actually crystallized in the context of the Israeli invasion. That said, you know, you're referring to something specific, which is how the U.S. And at the time, President Ronald Reagan treated Israel. And, you know, before even talking about the invasion of Lebanon in 1982, it's worth noting that in 1981, Israel carried out this kind of covert operation, bombing an Iraqi target, a nuclear reactor in Iraq, using American fighter jets. This was condemned in the United Nations, and President Reagan supported that condemnation, actually, supported the resolution condemning the Israeli attack and suspended the sale of U.S. aircraft to Israel after that. So that was 81. Then in 82, when Israel was carrying out this invasion, which, you know, folks may or may not know, involved horrific shelling in Beirut, involved Israeli forces presiding over the atrocious slaughter of people in the Palestinian refugee camps of Shabra and Shatila. And Israel wanted to do other things, including blow up a hotel in Beirut. And President Reagan called Prime Minister Begin on the phone and said, "Stop. You actually can't. You've got to cut it out. You've got to back down." And so they didn't go ahead with that particular attack on the hotel in Beirut, and in any case got the message that they do not have the green light from the United States here, and that had implications, you know, for how far Israel went. And so what we're seeing today is really the very opposite. There seems to be no condition that to Biden support for Israel, or there's no condition on the U.S. weapons going to Israel. Israel can attack hospitals, which they have done once again, attack the same hospital, Shifa. They're doing it right now. Can attack Palestinians in line to receive food, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, these are war crimes, and yet the military aid keeps flowing from the United States.
I mean, it's bizarre. You know, we're talking about Ronald Reagan over 40 years ago. This, you know, quite conservative Republican president telling Menachem Begin, you know, the then Prime Minister of Israel, to cut it out, stop it.
Yeah.
You know? And all we're getting now from the Biden administration and its surrogates, namely Senator Schumer, you know, giving a certain kind of rhetoric on the floor of the Senate saying, you know, this is not acceptable, but they're not actually going to, hey, we're going to cut off military aid. I mean, that's the essential question. And, you know, Bernie Sanders has a bill on the floor to do just that, but it's not going anywhere. Your thoughts about that?
Yeah, it's evident that the senior people in charge of the U.S. political class, of course, with the president himself, among them, their attitude is Israel wrong or right. You know, I mean, the commitment to Israel is so deep. And part of that involves this framework that they have, which is that Israel is fundamentally, you know, a project that we support. But Netanyahu is this kind of reckless, loose cannon. And you know, I don't know if we can trust this particular guy. And there's a lot of problems with this notion. And I'll say, too, I do think that part of it, and there's been a kind of, there's been beef, you know, between the U.S. Democrats and Netanyahu for a while, including going back to the Obama administration when Netanyahu came at the invitation of the Republican Speaker of the House and addressed a joint session of Congress to denounce Obama's Iran nuclear deal. You know, Biden is still mad about that. So they haven't liked Netanyahu for a while. But I do think, too, that part of it is that there's this kind of framework that they're using for U.S. domestic politics, whereas Biden sees himself as the good guy and Trump as the bad guy, and he sees Netanyahu as the analog to Trump. You know what I mean? And so in the same way that Kamala Harris spoke to Benny Gantz as this kind of alternative to Netanyahu, I think that Biden is thinking, okay, maybe Gantz is the Biden in this situation and Netanyahu is the Trump. And it's just wrong. It's a really, really wrong assessment. It fails to grasp what you just said a minute ago, the widespread support within the Israeli population, actually, for what is happening. That is, the whole Israeli population has moved so far to the right. And the current Israeli government, which is the furthest right in Israeli history, which is really saying a lot, you know, for a country that has a pretty, you know, that has a far right, like a secular far right and a religious far right. You know, there's a lot of right wing stuff. And this is the furthest right. And, you know, for Israel's Jewish citizens, it is quite democratic, actually. Like, I mean, this really does reflect attitudes. And the way that I'll just to throw out a kind of analytical piece on that, I think about what it meant in this country that when Donald Trump was the president, you know, what that meant for U.S. politics, what that meant for what a section of the U.S. population came to accept, you know, that they would defend putting children in cages at the border, for example, and all kinds of other horrendous things, the Muslim ban. I mean, all of these just cruel policies. That was under 4 years of Trump. Consider that Netanyahu has been prime minister on and off for like 12 years. You know what I mean? Like that is both reflective of a trend in Israeli politics and also a driver of it. And so this is all to say that the notion that Netanyahu is the problem here, and if that we can just get a reasonable, cooler head, to be prime minister, right, which I believe is that's what Biden and Schumer believe. It's so wrong. And in the meantime, because of their commitment to Israel as a state, they'll rhetorically criticize Netanyahu. Abstaining on this UN Security Council vote is the furthest they've gone in terms of action. But the key thing is the weapons, and the weapons keep flowing.
Right. I mean, you know, those that say that, the military industrial complex is in play, have a point here. I mean, it would seem that that certainly is the case. I mean, can it be argued that Bibi Netanyahu doesn't really care about the politics of this election year in the United States? I mean, he would just assume have Biden lose and have Trump back in there. And Trump is certainly, with his son-in-law Kushner, supportive of more supportive of Israel. I mean, I've seen polls that say that young people think that things would be better under Trump versus Biden in terms of the Middle East. I mean, it's really quite insane. Arguably, I mean, as you know, and all of this is evidenced by Secretary of State Blinken being recently in Israel. And while he's there, he gets a exceedingly serious snub with the expansion of a settlement in the West Bank. I mean, Netanyahu clearly doesn't care at the least about the prospects for electoral politics here in the United States vis-a-vis Biden.
Yeah, I mean it's a pretty interesting and complex situation, because first of all, let's remember that Netanyahu himself is facing all kinds of criminal charges for corruption. He has a personal stake in being prime minister as long as possible, because presumably once that ends, he is vulnerable to actually being held accountable for his crimes under Israeli criminal law. So that's number one. Number two is, prior to October, Israeli politics and society was actually being shaken by a massive opposition where like half the country wanted Netanyahu out. I mean, like really powerful protests against Netanyahu's efforts at what he calls judicial reform. And so he was trying to navigate that reality. He had this very tenuous government after several Israeli elections. I mean, that is, Israeli politics has been unstable for a while. And this quote unquote war, this bombardment, this genocidal bombardment that Israel's carrying out, that's kind of Netanyahu's ticket for the closest thing that they can get to a kind of Israeli political unity. And so he has a real personal and political stake in prolonging this thing as long as possible. And in terms of his attitudes toward the US election, again, at the end of the day, if the weapons keep coming, he has no reason to question, his approach to Washington, because Washington keeps on sending weapons. So he can say he has the green light, essentially. Maybe sometimes he gets a yellow light, but he's moving forward, and there's no reason to rethink that. There's been quite a bit of reporting, particularly in the Israeli media, about how utterly dependent Israel is on U.S. ammunition right now. I mean, the kind of tank shells that they're using, for example, they don't produce, sufficiently in Israel. The bombs that they're using, the aircraft that they're using, all of the manned aircraft that Israel's using, all of it comes from the United States. And this is sophisticated aircraft that needs a ton of maintenance. They need part. It's not like you buy this plane and then you just have it. I mean, they need a steady flow of ammunition and all kinds of technical parts. And so, if the White House said we are pausing weapons, then I'd be curious. Maybe Netanyahu would all of a sudden be interested, in U.S. politics. until that happens, he has no incentive to. The last thing I just want to say, it is about Biden and where he's at, because he's making a calculation. He's making a number of calculations, one of which is, people may not like this Israel policy I'm doing, but Trump is so much worse that at the end of the day, these people are going to have to vote for me. I think he's wrong. I think the notion that, genocide Joe as a label, he thinks, yeah, they say that now, it's not going to stick by November. I think that he's miscalculating. The other thing, keep in mind, the U.S. is bombing Yemen right now as well. Do you know what I mean? Like, this is like Biden has a worldview that's like the U.S. and Israel, we will dominate, even though these operations in Yemen are also failing. So I think this is actually pretty consistent. I think that Biden is consistently misreading the situation and making a series of decisions that are not only horrendous from an ethical and humanitarian perspective, but are actually also missteps geopolitically.
Yeah, we're going to have to end it there. We're going to have to get you back, Curry. It's such a compelling issue, and it's compelling in part because we are, as United States taxpayers, supporting this, right, this arguable genocide. I mean, it's just terrific, and we need to get you back. I appreciate you joining us today. I've been speaking with Curry Peterson Smith of the Institute for Policy Studies. Thank you very much for joining us. We need to get you back soon. Thank you again.
Thank you for having this really important discussion, David. Take care.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thank you. And I'm from the macro to the micro. There's a threat to a local park in Northwest D.C. Joining us to lay out the scenario are members of Bruce Monroe Park Neighbors. And I'm joined now by Adam Green of that organization. Welcome. And we welcome caller 202-588-0893. Would like you to chime in if you have an interest in the story. Welcome to Community Watch and Comment, Adam.
Thank you. Thank you for focusing on the local as well as the international.
Yeah, and we've got Nita from your organization joining us now. And welcome to you both. So we've got some green space that many of us might not know about in terms of Bruce Monroe Park and the threat to it. Lay out the scenario for you, if you would, Adam.
Sure. I mean, this is really the story of local people losing trust in local government, but fighting back against very powerful interests to save a local park that the community uses. The Bruce Monroe Park is about two blocks north of Howard University. On any given day, you'll see parents and grandparents pushing their kids on a swing, other toddlers playing on a little jungle gym, teenagers playing on the multiple basketball courts in the park, middle-aged people playing tennis, classes taking place in a community gazebo or at the local community garden, and people walking their dog in the dog park or on the acre or so of green space where the Parks and Recreation Department typically has many community events during the summer. It's the jewel of the local community, the community called Parkview. But local developers are trying to basically privatize it for $1 a year in order to build a 10-story tower amidst two-story to three-story row houses, bodegas, and small businesses. And local neighbors have been fighting back, including just this past week, testifying in front of the city council, asking them, please don't dispose of this local park. Don't privatize it. Stick up for your constituents.
I mean, we should point out that this 10-story tower is for, in large part, or will include, however you want to describe it, affordable housing, which is important. I mean, but I think that your organization is saying, hey, yeah, that is important, but is there some alternative to taking away important green space in a unlimited community in Northwest D.C.?
Yes, I'll let Nita comment more on that.
So,
Nita, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having us. So just for some background, when DemPED and the DC Housing Authority put out a solicitation to get bids for developers to do this work, that solicitation required developers to demonstrate control of a site on Georgia Avenue to build what's called Build First housing. And that was so that when residents were moved out of the Park Morton public housing, that they would have a site to go to, and then they could eventually relocate back to the Park Morton site. That requirement is in place, not only as a, you know, a policy goal of not displacing people, but also as a requirement for any HUD-supported housing project before that housing project can be taken down and the land can be, you know, used for other purposes or sold. You legally, the federal government requires that replacement housing be provided. And so two things are happening. The Park Morton residents have been displaced and they are not there. So it's a policy question of like, if you've already displaced residents, why is there this pressing need to, you know, destroy green space in order to provide the alternative housing? And also, why did they select a developer that didn't meet the requirements of the solicitation to actually provide control over a site? Like, you know, the solicitation was very clear that, you know, developers had to provide alternative, you know, locations to put that Build First housing, and they didn't do that. And why is the council member for this ward so interested in giving away public land, part of which was acquired by eminent domain, to enrich a developer? And the other thing that's happening here is this entire proposal, the goal is to privatize public housing, and there's no guarantee anywhere that that's going to remain affordable housing in perpetuity. So really what's happening is the council member is very gung-ho about enriching a developer and relieving DC government of the requirement to maintain and provide affordable housing. So it's the guise is affordable housing, you know, but that's not what's happening. And the policy objectives are really, in my opinion, just morally bankrupt.
And if I could add one thing to that, Anita is really an expert on kind of the ins and outs of, you know, how this has gone over the years. You know, I've been very involved with organizing local neighbors to speak out. And one thing that the record is replete with is members of the community saying, please build more housing, build more affordable housing in our backyards. Just don't take away our park to do it. There are dilapidated lots and vacant lots, lots for sale, government-owned lots right in the area that have very little use, whereas this park is the crown jewel of our community. But because it's so valuable, that's why a developer wants it to be privatized. And also, you know, about a third of the homes in this tower are slated for public housing, as Nita said. The public housing residents don't support this project. It would vastly make their quality of life worse than it's been in years past. On the third of the slots that are supposed to be quote unquote affordable housing, the metrics that those are based on are based on, you know, median income in very wealthy suburbs like Bethesda and Chevy Chase and Georgetown and Old Town Alexandria. And that's why Howard students and workers in the area oppose this project, because it won't actually be affordable for them. As Nita said, it's a guise. What it's really about is the penthouse towers at the top, the apartments that they will get very high rates for. But the net effect of this tower is it will really destroy a local community and take away quality of life for kids, parents, grandparents, and just people that want physical and mental health.
I mean, what's your understanding of why the city is promoting this? I mean, it's, you know, if in fact it's for the enrichment of these developers stuff, I mean, there are alternatives to where this kind of development could be offered in the community. Is there not? I mean, It's kind of, you know, it leaves you scratching your head as to why, you know, the city is promoting, appears to be promoting, you know, taking away green space, and you know, very limited green space from the community. Whoever wants to answer that, go at it.
I think one argument that I've heard DemPED make is that, you know, building more housing will inherently, like by increasing the supply, will make housing more affordable. And Adam laid out the reasons that that isn't entirely true based, you know, when they're creating this calculation of what's considered affordable and they're really skewing the math on it. And I think the intention is to add more density. And, you know, the like application for the development cited all of these other, you know, in the works developments in the area that would be equally sized. Many of those have been built and they have not been built to the 9 or 10 stories. So I think the council member has this view of what she wants this stretch of Georgia Avenue to look like. And, you know, the theory is adding a lot more housing will inherently make things more affordable. And we know that's not true. It has to be a very intentional policy process in order for that to be achieved.
Yeah. And the council member that Nita is referring to is Brianne Nadeau, the Ward 1 councilwoman. And she has made very clear in public statements and private conversations that her rationale for wanting to do this is to put a bullet point on campaign literature saying that she created more housing. I mean, it's really that simple and that unfortunate. There was another unfortunate situation recently where our local advisory neighborhood commission held a hearing on this. And dozens of people showed up to testify. 90% of them were against this project. They made very clear arguments as to why, at minimum, the ANC should pause their consideration of basically recommending to the council that this be done. And nonetheless, the local advisory neighborhood commission that works hand in hand with Brianne Nadeau voted 7-0 against the community and in favor of the developers. So it's really, again, that's why I say this is a story of people who are getting increasingly disenchanted with government and everyday people standing up to big developers and asking the city council to do the right thing. And I will say that Kenny McDuffie, who held a hearing about a week ago, has done the most good faith hearing so far, really internalizing community feedback, then asking tough questions of the mayor's office, the DemPed office that Nita referred to. And we're very hopeful that we can get a good faith set of ears when this comes before the full council soon.
So what are you recommending that people do? I think the deadline for getting comments in on this development has passed. I think it passed last week, but what are you recommending that people do now that are concerned about the situation with the park?
Well, anybody who is sympathetic to this effort and would like to get involved, it would be great if you could actually email us, neighborsofparkview@gmail.com. Neighbors, plural, of parkview@gmail.com. And we'll loop you into efforts to fight back. Recently, those efforts have looked like showing up at local ANC and city council meetings. In the future, it might be doing petitioning in the park when there are big community events happening. It's been so sad to just talk to parents about this who have no idea this is about to happen to the swings that they are pushing for their kids. So there really is kind of empowerment that happens as the community galvanizes and talks to other neighbors, neighbor to neighbor, peer to peer. So that's the number one thing people could do is neighborsofparkview@gmail.com. But Nita, do you want to talk more about community activism so far?
So I think it's important not just for people in Ward 1, but I think every ward has an interest in whether or not city council is going to approve of these type of plans. Like, what would you do if they decided to build on, you know, the very limited green space in your neighborhood? And do you think it's appropriate for the entire council to take the view that, you know, oh, we'll defer to the council member whose, you know, ward this is because this isn't in my neighborhood? This is DC owned land that was acquired by eminent domain. And this shouldn't be a policy that anybody is advocating anywhere in the district at all. There's the law that governs a process of declaring land surplus and disposing of it has had a recent insertion saying that the city needs to take an inventory of the green space and what's been done to increase green space. Like, that's part of the law that city council is going to be looking at when they're voting on this. And we should really be looking at this as a DC-wide issue. Like, this isn't good policy. This shouldn't happen anywhere in DC.
Yeah. And we're talking about, I mean, the time frame here is pretty imminent. I mean, we're already past the time for people to weigh in on public comments. I mean, this is an imminent decision, if I'm not mistaken.
It's not imminent. There's months more in the process. And, you know, while the public comment period around this hearing has ended, people can contact their city council member at any point, and we will facilitate that happening. And as Nita said, we need members in other wards and the at-large members to not just defer to one council person who, frankly, is just drinking their own Kool-Aid on this and is very out of touch with the community. So there's actually real power in other people around the district who are hearing this right now, who might think, oh, this isn't my part of town, I shouldn't get involved. There's actually extra power in you stepping up and emailing us at neighborsofparkview@gmail.com so that we can make sure that we have a totality approach to council engagement and really ask them to do the right thing. And one other thing I would just add, by the way, is that the Zoning Commission initially acknowledged zero adverse impacts on the community, harms to the community. And a court actually intervened and said, no, this is not good faith. You basically copied and pasted the developer's proposal into your order. You need to go back to the drawing board and let us know what adverse impacts there will be on the community. And surprise, surprise, things that they had not told the public and not told the council include air pollution, reduced emergency response time, diminished public safety, noise pollution, diminished water, diminished electricity, diminished gas, diminished environmental protection. All these things that when the council actually initially considered this years ago and gave the green light, which we're now thinking about doing again since there have been some delays, were all hidden from the council and the public. So again, for people across the district, like Nita said, this could happen in your community. Ambulances could be slowed down, emergency management, safety could be diminished, and the council could turn a blind eye to it if their local ward city council person says, oh, I like this project for my own campaign reasons. So that's why this is a moment of truth. This is a fork in the road for the district as a whole that's playing out at Bruce Monroe Park near Howard University.
We need to end it there. Please give again the site that people can go to if they want to support your efforts. Your website, please.
Well, neighborsofparkview@gmail.com is the email address to email us at. There's also a Neighbors of Parkview website that's a little out of date, but you can also check that out if you'd like to.
But one more thing to add, Adam mentioned it, but this is on the direct route to Children's Hospital, Washington Hospital Center, and the VA. So if you or your child has to ever go to that hospital, like that's hospital center, this will impact you. This is going to be a 10-story building on one of the busiest crosstown routes. And DC is pretending, the developer and DC government is pretending that this is not going to have a traffic impact, which is just a bald-faced lie.
I want to thank you all for all you're doing in support of the community and in your efforts, Adam and Nita. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Okay, take care. And on to our last subject here, from the micro to the international. I'm joined by Janet Anthony of Bloom Haiti, who has, I think, relatively speaking, a positive story to tell about the horrific situation going on in Haiti. Janet Anthony, thank you so much for joining us. I think you've got your mute on. I'm not hearing you.
Yes, sorry about that.
There you go.
You'd think that one would learn after all these years.
I mean, you're a wonderful cellist. We don't want to mute you.
Thank you so much for having me, David. I really appreciate the opportunity.
This is a longtime friend, I think of over 50 years, of fellow cellists. It's great to have you on. It's so great that you're doing the work. You're based in New Mexico, and talk about how you got involved in this and why you're carrying the torch for young people in Haiti.
Well, again, thank you for the opportunity. My first trip to Haiti was back in 1996. I can't believe it's been almost 28 years. This summer will be 28 years. And I went sort of on a whim. I saw an ad for a cello teacher needed for a festival. I speak French. I thought, why not? And I got totally hooked after that first trip. And I've gone back, except for the pandemic, every year since, normally a couple times a year. And I have to say, from the very beginning, what impressed me the most, what touched me the most, what inspired me the most was the determination and desire and drive of these young musicians. Many of whom I've known for 28 years, some of whom I'm now teaching their kids and working with their kids. It's been awesome to see. And With everything that's going on, and now and in previous iterations, I was in Haiti actually in 2004. I left the country just a week before Aristide was spirited out by U.S. Marines, eventually winding up in South Africa. And I was what they call en bas la ville, downtown, with a lot of violence, a lot of disruption. This is in the capital as bad and even worse than what I experienced then. But what's different now between 2004 and what's happening now is that there are music programs all over the country. And except for some of the programs in the capital that we support, these are functioning relatively normally. And even in the capital, we support about 20 music programs, and over half of them are still able to have classes and rehearsals and lessons and things of that nature, which is pretty remarkable when one considers what's going on in the metropolitan Port-au-Prince area. But for example, in Jacmel, a southern coastal city, we just finished three band instrument repair sessions that impacted about 30 people who now have the skills to add to their economic capacity and who are able to repair instruments for their home music schools, which means that more instruments can get into the hands of teachers and kids. And we're going to be doing the same thing in the north in a week or two. And things continue apace, as I mentioned, with rehearsals and.
Oh dear.
Oh dear. Yes.
I don't know about you, but I'm having. I'm having internet. If you could repeat what you just said, we had a internet hiccup. If you could repeat what you just said about the programs, I mean, I think your main point is, or one of your main points is that. There's ongoing, very positive efforts going on in Haiti that often don't get reported on. We're hearing about the clear tumult. Excuse me, the
Bless
clear
you.
Tumult in Port-au-Prince and the capital, but you know you've been dealing with efforts going on in the south and Jacmel and Cap-Haïtien in the north that are ongoing. They're quite positive. Excuse me. The ongoing situation is not completely fallen apart, if you will.
But Port-au-Prince is a catastrophe. There's no denying that. And sort of the dithering on the part of the international community and within various factions and in various factions within Haiti is very problematic. But despite that, there are very positive things happening throughout the country, and even in fact in the capital of Port-au-Prince. That, and of course, the media focuses on the terrible events that are happening, and they are terrible. But there is more to the story than that, as you put it. There is a ray of light. There is ample room for hope, despite the difficulties in the country at the moment.
I mean, talk about your organization, Bloom. What it stands for? It's an acronym, and what your larger mission is in terms of Haiti, because it's really quite extraordinary.
So Bloom stands for Building Leaders Using Music Education in Haiti. And we formed shortly after the horrific 2010 earthquake that killed 200 to 300,000 people in the greater Port-au-Prince area. We'll never know how many. We were looking for a way to bring instruments and supplies to some of the music schools that have been destroyed in that event. And our purpose really is to use music as a force for social change. And in the intervening 11 to 12 years, what we've seen across Haiti is an explosion of music schools. What music...
Janet, the internet connection is not good and you're breaking up. I wonder if our dear engineer could get a phone contact with you, because we do have 4 minutes remaining and you're breaking up on us. Can our engineer possibly reconnect us on the phone? And we're going to have to, I don't know, this is a, underhanded attempt by Zoom to break up an important conversation about serious support for the people of Haiti.
I'm available by phone if the engineer would like to do that.
I think the engineer has your number, if he could do that. And let's soldier on, if you will.
Should I?
On the internet, we're going to have to reconsider doing Zoom here, but I want you to be heard loud and clear.
Let me move to a different room, so hopefully there's no interference there. Is it better?
I'm hearing you. Yeah.
Okay.
Let's go with that.
Great. Bloom Haiti was founded after the earthquake and as a way to support music programs. And in the 11 years since then, we've seen an explosion of music programs across Haiti. And the point I was trying to make earlier is that community leaders, parents, music program leaders, they all see music as a way to help orient the young people in their community. Haiti is a country without a lot of options for young people. It's also a really young country. 65% of the population is under the age of 25. And what music helps people do, the skills you learn through music education of developing leadership qualities, of resilience, of self-confidence, these kinds of things will help orient kids in a community and young adults, adolescents, in a very positive and healthy way. And this is what community leaders tell us. This is what parents tell me. They see music as a shield to help protect their kids against the dangers and temptations of gang life. Gangs in Haiti are recruiting younger and younger kids, which is very, very disturbing, because these youngsters, once they get involved in that kind of life, it's very hard to leave that. And it's very hard to leave that if they don't have skills and if they don't have other options. So that's one of the underlying features of the work that we do that is definitely supported and informed and led by our Haitian partners.
And just tell folks, if they want to follow and support your work, how they can keep in contact with your wonderful project, Bloom.
Oh, thank you for that opportunity as well. We are on the internet at BLUMEHAITI, and you can contact me at Janet or info@bloomhaiti.org. We're on Facebook, we're on Instagram, we're on LinkedIn. Remember that it's BLUME, not BLOOM, bloomhaiti.org.
Right. Janet Anthony, Executive Director of Bloom, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate you being with us today and for all that you're doing. Really much
thank
appreciated.
You for the opportunity. I can't, I appreciate it so much. Thank you.
Take care. And that's going to do it for our show. A couple of announcements. There is an event on Cuba at Sankofa Books. that 2714 Georgia Avenue, that's Sankofa Books, S-A-N-K-O-F-A Books, a wonderful bookstore community space at 2714 Georgia Avenue, just above Howard University. This coming Saturday, 6:30 to 8:30, the program will feature Alejandro Del Toro, who is the Deputy Chief of Mission Embassy at the Republic of Cuba. So please check it out this coming Saturday, 6:30 to 8:30. And also, I want to let you know that there's a memorial service for the wonderful Dory Ladner, an incredible civil rights activist from back in the 60s, who passed recently. The memorial will be at Shiloh Baptist Church, 1400 9th Street Northwest, on Saturday, April 13th. So do check it out. And that's going to do it for our show. Thank you so much for joining us. Stay tuned for the incredible blues that our next host will offer. Thank you so much for joining us. Take care, and we will see you very soon. Thanks for listening. Dave Raven, take care. Bye-bye.
From WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are the headlines. Baltimore's Francis Scott Key Bridge collapsed overnight after one of its support pillars was struck by a container ship. Baltimore City Fire Chief James Wallace told reporters this morning that the scene was an active search and rescue and that authorities were looking for at least six individuals. He said at least two people have been rescued from the water. One wasn't hurt, and one was in very serious condition. Maryland Governor Wes Moore said the crew on the ship were able to issue a mayday before colliding into the bridge, which allowed the authorities to stop incoming traffic from going onto the bridge. It was not immediately clear what caused the ship to crash into the bridge. The four-lane, 1.6-mile-long bridge spans the Patapsco River and opened in 1977. The Maryland Transportation Authority is searching for alternative transport options for the roughly 35,000 people using the bridge every day, noting that they will be directing people to instead use two major tunnels, the Harbor Tunnel and the Fort McHenry Tunnel. In other news, Russian President Vladimir Putin, for the first time yesterday, acknowledged that Friday's attack at a concert hall outside Moscow was carried out by Islamic militants, but again attempted to blame Ukraine. Putin said in televised remarks that the Kremlin was investigating who ordered the attack, in which 139 people were killed, and implied Kyiv was responsible. Ukraine has rejected the Russian claim as absurd. Russian authorities have detained 11 people, including four men from Tajikistan, who were arraigned in a district court late Sunday and charged with committing a terrorist act. They all appear to have been badly beaten, possibly during interrogations. An affiliate of the Islamic State, ISIS-K, has claimed responsibility and posted video of the attack. An appeals court yesterday ruled former President Donald Trump can have 10 additional days to pay a reduced $175 million bond to appeal the $454 million civil fraud judgment against him, his adult sons, and his company. The ruling for now staves off the prospect of the New York Attorney General seeking to seize his property to enforce the judgment. Trump was ordered to pay the penalty after a New York City judge in February found that Trump repeatedly lied about the value of his assets over several years to secure loans and make deals. His sons and former Trump Organization CFO Alan Weisselberg were also ordered to pay about $10 million in financial penalties. And Florida Governor Ron DeSantis signed into law yesterday one of the country's most restrictive social media laws, banning accounts for children under 14 and requiring parental permission for 15 to 16-year-olds. The bill, assuming it survives legal challenge, will take effect January 1st. DeSantis's signature comes a few weeks after he vetoed an earlier version of the bill that would have banned all youth under 16 from possessing social media accounts, regardless of parental permission. The new law mirrors some passed in other states. In Arkansas, a federal judge last year blocked enforcement of a bill requiring parental consent for youth to create a social media account. Other laws have been passed in Texas, Louisiana,